from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. Now, as we can see, South Dakota is not, but it also never has been, immune to epidemic or pandemic levels of communicable diseases. For Monday's Images of the Past segment, we were joined by SDPB's Brian Gevick and Matthew Reitzel. Matthew is the manuscript archivist at the South Dakota State Archives in Pierre. Let's take a listen.
Brian, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Oh, glad to be here with you.
Matthew, welcome back as well.
Hello, Lori.
All right, Brian, I want to start with you because I was reading this information, which is fabulous to read through, and made me feel really grateful that I live in 2020 instead of, as difficult as this situation is, boy, there's been some tough times in the past. Is that how you're usually supposed to respond to history? Is that, thank God I didn't live back then?
I think it's a pretty natural response,
and
we tend to romanticize life back then, I'm sure,
yeah.
But in the end, it would have been perhaps a little nastier than we think.
All right. Tell us a little bit about some of the information you found. Let's start with Matthew.
Oh, okay. I think a good place to start, I guess, Lori, is I went and found a copy of the Aberdeen Daily American from October 15th. Of 1918, and it has a little story there about how to check Spanish influenza. Mm. And there's a list of 12 things, and it was put together by the Surgeon General and also the president of the time, Woodrow Wilson, and lists 12 things altogether. But the top three here, I guess, or number one, was avoid needless crowding. Influenza is a crowded disease. The second one was smother your coughs and sneezes. And the third one was wash your hands.
Huh.
So even though it's been 102 years since Spanish influenza, we still kind of have been hearing the same things. You know, avoid crowds,
yeah.
Cover your cough, sneezes, wash your hands. So some things do remain the same, even though time has passed.
And is there evidence from the archives that people were taking that seriously? Was it working? Were they able? You know, what were some of the challenges that they faced, the stories that you found?
One of the things that I did beforehand here, Lori, is I kind of went through to our Chronicling America website,
mm-hmm.
Which is through the Library of Congress. It has a number of South Dakota newspapers, which people can access online. And I took a look at the Madison Daily Leader. That was one of the newspapers that was at the Chronicling America website for that time frame. There's a number of stories in there concerning... you can almost like see the Spanish flu making its way towards South Dakota. The first reference made in the newspaper is in September 16th that the flu was in Boston. And then on the 21st, Madison resident Elmer Davis, who was stationed at the Great Lake Naval Station in Illinois, had died of Spanish flu, and his family was out there. And then there's stories about flus in all the camps. And then it's making its, you know, it's in Minneapolis by October 2nd. It's in Des Moines in October 3rd. And then by October 3rd, it's at the School of Mines and in Rapid City. So you can just kind of see this wave coming, I guess. And then in October 9th, the Madison City Commission had a meeting trying to decide what kind of preventative things they could do to stop the spread of Spanish influenza. And they noticed that they made reference to other cities were closing schools and churches and things like that, and that people shouldn't be in large numbers. But from that October 9th meeting, there wasn't any action taken. It was just like they came together and were thinking of things to do. A few days later, a group of Madison businessmen, which I would just refer to as the Chamber of Commerce of the day, I guess, were saying the same things, like we should probably start closing stuff. It's the right thing to do. But even then, it was saying public gatherings were still happening. And then the next day, October 12th, there was a headline that was titled Public Assemblages. And there the city commission finally came together and prohibited all meetings of, mm-hmm. you know, closing schools, churches, everything like that. And that there was a case of Spanish influenza then in the city of Madison. So the first reference happens on September 16th, where the flu is in Boston, and less than a month later, it's already in Madison. So wow. You can kind of see those things that were happening, the thoughts going on, what things we should do at, you know, at the state level, at the city level, and different different ways that they were trying to handle that.
Brian Gibbick, let's talk a little bit about smallpox and what you were able to find about the history of smallpox epidemic on the Great Plains.
Yeah, it has a really long history. It goes back to the fur trappers and traders way back in the 18th century. The first recorded incidence of smallpox among the native tribes living along the Missouri River was in 1781. There was another outbreak in 1801, but the largest outbreak and the most disastrous happened in 1837. And by this time, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and the Arikara tribes had moved up the river into what's now North Dakota, and they'd established a camp on the Knife River, which is quite close to an installation, an outpost, rather, named Fort Clark. Now, steamboats were coming up the river in the 1830s, and they were, you know, doing their trade and then going back down to St. Louis. In 1837, a boat named the St. Peters left Fort Pier, traveled up to Fort Clark, and proceeded to do its business. The captain of the steamboat knew that he had a case of smallpox on board. The superintendent of the fort knew that there was smallpox on board that boat. In fact, he sent his son away, sent him down to Fort Pier and then eventually farther east. Reportedly, there was a big party when the boat docked. Transactions were made, business was done. And very quickly thereafter, the Mandan, Arikara, and Hidatsa people started to get sick, and they started dying in just huge numbers. The superintendent kept a log, and he wasn't really able to keep track of it. The result in the end was that there had been about 2,000 Mandan living in that area. By the time it was over, there were 138. That's, you know, 90% of the population in that area was wiped out. The Arikara and Hidatsa were halved, and they were subsequently weakened. It was a few months later that reports came that the disease had spread among the Sioux, which were several hundred miles to the south. Now, I think that the lesson I'm getting from this is mainly this, that the people in charge knew what was going on, they had choices to make, and they made the most disastrous choices they could possibly make by just going ahead and, you know, going on with business as usual.
Did they not know, or did they not care?
I think it was they did know.
Mm-hmm.
I to what extent they cared or to what extent they were ignorant, I wouldn't be able to say. They shouldn't have been ignorant. Smallpox had been around for centuries. It wasn't something that was unknown. And as a matter of fact, there was a federal program in 1832 to inoculate some of the natives and some of the other people living in this area. Unfortunately, a lot of natives didn't have access to those vaccines.
You can find this information at sdpb.org for images of the past. Brian Gibbick, a lot more lessons from history here in the future, I suspect. Thanks for bringing this to us. Are you looking into more stories in our remaining 15 seconds here?
Yeah, we do have a couple of things going on. We're going to meet to talk about some of the coverage that we can do. I just want to throw out a couple of other numbers here, looking at some of the other issues. West Nile, mm-hmm. in particular in South Dakota, isn't something that we should forget about. 2,359 people have contracted West Nile disease in South Dakota, and that's going to be back. Not a very bright and sunny thing to be talking about, I know, but I think it's important to look at some of the lessons learned and to look at, you know, how history has judged events when procedures aren't followed and people just ignore what's going on.
Thank you.
Now, just like back then, South Dakotans have been asked to stay at home in order to slow the spread of coronavirus, protect the vulnerable, and things like keep healthcare workers safe. But nobody said that was going to be easy. And for many people, staying home is fraught with perils of their own. This also holds true for veteran reporter Kevin Wooster. He joined Lori Walsh to talk about the struggles he's dealing with.
Kevin, are you at home?
I am at home. It's the weather's, conducive to keeping me here, so I'm at home.
And we'll be clear, Kevin's not running out to, be irresponsible. So we're just.
Definitely not.
But staying at home is a little bit can be a little bit stir crazy for a lot of people. Tell me about what it's like for you.
Well, it drives me a little crazy, yeah, because I like to spend time at home, and I spend a lot of time in my office in my den and reading in the kitchen and stuff, and then I usually go someplace and I go to coffee with my buddies. I got a couple of groups and different people that you go like to sit and talk about politics and hunting and fishing and all kinds of stuff. And I go to noon mass, several times a week, three or four times usually, along with Sunday. And I have a family there, spiritual family. And the YMCA workouts, I say in my blog that I was dubbed the mayor of the Y by one of my friends who considers my workouts sometimes more conversational than physical. And then the Y, you get these patterns that you go into. You go from the Y to the library and see what's new and check out the periodicals and read the newspapers and see the people there. And all of that, is not just the other stuff, like going to basketball games or going to concerts or going to small group musical presentations or art shows.
Right.
All of that's off, and you find yourself here feeling generally safe, although we have some complications involving 18 grandkids, 14 of whom are in Rapid City, who are accustomed to showing up here, kids from college age to one. So.
Mm-hmm.
Those are interesting issues that have become more of a discussion point and an action point since we had our confirmed case, first of what I assume will be a number of confirmed cases here in the Black Hills.
Right. For so many people, this is an outdoor state. This is a place where people, there's hunting and fishing and hiking and climbing, and there's just a lot of sense that, outdoors is home. Outdoors is sheltering in place for a lot of people. When you do go out, and because people have been asking those questions, like, what can I go out and do? And they're like, well, taking a walk is fine as long as you stay away, from people. But with more and more people taking a walk, is it getting crowded out there in some of your favorite places?
Well, I sit here and look out over the St. Cloud Street, which leads up two blocks to an entrance point in the trail system up in the Skyline Drive nature. And I can tell you that the flow of people there is multiple times normal on a given day. Mm. And when we went to Bear Butte, one of the grandsons who lived with us for 10 years, so we're having a little bit of trouble disconnecting from him. He's a middle schooler and probably shouldn't be coming over for a while. He lives with his mom now. And then we have a college-age granddaughter living with us. We flew back from the East Coast. And so we're kind of keeping an idea on 14 days and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So we're here, and I watch people go by, but the four of us, my wife, Mary, and the two grandkids went to Bear Butte to hike, get out. Normally in Bear Butte, you see five or six or seven people on the hike up and back. I suppose we saw 25 or more. And it even makes you a little nervous on the narrow trail where you're going almost elbow to elbow with people. So we would wait for places where we'd step off the trail and let people coming up the trail move you're out in the outdoors with a wind, but you think, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they say if you walk through a virus cloud, someone could cough if they have it 3 hours later. You could still, it's no joke. It's hard to, but it is kind of easy to forget when you do. We've been talking a lot about, turning off, Governor Kristi Noem even said yesterday, everybody take a breath and relax. But when you do that, it's also, it's shocking to shock yourself back into vigilance, too. Sometimes when you take a breath and take a break, you can forget just how serious and how important it is to take those measures that are, really out of. This is more than just how we normally wash our hands, let's be honest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My hands are so dry, I don't know what to do with them. I'm getting sanitized and getting, rubbing alcohol treatment, you know, getting washed. And we're washing counters so much more and sanitizing doorknobs and all this kind of stuff. And, yeah, we've reached the point where family members other than the one that lives with us are kind of restricted in entering the house. And and my son, the doctor, has suggested the grandkids can come over on sunny days and play in the backyard. And we can cut up some peanut butter sandwiches and feed them out there and generally not have them come in the house for a while. And,
right.
You know, keep even there outside, try to keep a reasonable distance. And
one of the things that I found on social media is I watched so many of my friends, you know, because clearly we're working more, not less, you know, right now. So we're very, very busy.
Sure.
I see some of the people who are, you know, struggling with what to do with some of their free time and missing those social interactions and having virtual, you know, wine parties and stuff. And they're like, I miss this group of friends. And I'm like, I was never invited to those parties in the first place. And I'm like, have y'all been meeting every week for wine? And I didn't even know about it. So I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I can feel your pain on that one.
Like, I didn't know I missed it because I didn't do it. But apparently that's a thing. And and maybe when this is all over, I'll want to be part of that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe you'll still be invited. Who knows?
And maybe I'll still be invited.
And yesterday, day before yesterday, Tuesday, when I was by myself, in areas where there wasn't a busy trail, you know, relatively speaking busy, down at Jewel Cave on a trail along Hell Canyon and down at Wind Cave down into Coldbrook Canyon Trail, and then casting a few jigs for walleyes unsuccessfully at the Angostura Reservoir. That was just me in a whole day. And as I say in the blog column, I went for hours without feeling anxious. And and you, without giving up what you need in the way of vigilance and responsibility, oh my gosh, that was good for me to just to have a few hours off when I didn't think about COVID-19 and everything was normal and familiar and beautiful and exhilarating. And I needed that. And I think we all need that. And we have to find ways to get that.
Right. I remember writing about after September 11th, taking Jane, my daughter was just a baby then. She was maybe, I don't know, she's born in March, so just, you know, a few months old, not even a year. And after everything that was happened, turning off the TV and taking her outside and taking her for a walk and just repeating to my, looking up the sky and saying, there's no planes, like, it's not happening here. Even though we didn't know what was going to happen next, and it was a time of huge anxiety, just to say, at this moment, at this right moment, here I am with my daughter, we're breathing, we're safe. And I think a lot of people are finding that as well, that they need to sit back and say, you know, today we're not sick. Today we're doing the things that we need to be doing. Today the hospital has enough supplies. Today we have enough food. Today we have our jobs, or, you know, we don't have our jobs, but, you know, we have unemployment insurance coming our way or whatnot. And because the future right now, just if you get in your head, it can be, it can unravel you a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even here in the house, Mary tries to remind me, be in the moment here. You know, try and be with us here. And because I get out and I watch too much cable news and I listen too many radio reports sometimes on it and I read too many stories online sometimes. And, you know, you try to figure it out and you try to come to a conclusion and I can't. And then you finally just have to give up and say, I have to breathe and I have to walk and I have to consider these things that are beyond this and believe that we will find them again.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I was doing out in the cave tours and the trails and the places like that. Because, you know, to clarify, there's no cave tours going on, obviously.
Right.
But
yeah.
I was touring with myself. So.
It seems like now is a perfect time to have a little more grace and forgiveness, too. Earlier in the hour, we talked about, you know, parenting and, you know, grandparenting and taking care of your parents. And we can't do this perfectly. We never could. And now it's pretty obvious that we can't. So take a big exhale right now and realize that we're all humans having a human experience together all over the planet, really. I mean, not in isolation in that way.
Yeah. And as I said on one guy's social media page the other day, I said, I was so hoping that we could just stop this predictable political partisan back and forth, the bickering, the angry, the mean-spirited. Can't we all just believe that we're all people with this one objective, and that's to, you know, stay safe and to to help each other and to try and find resources, because they were arguing about, you know, this is all a show to get Trump. And I said, I don't care about Trump, and I don't care about the election right now, and I don't care about any of that stuff. Let's just keep people alive as much as we can and keep people healthy as much as we can and stop hating each other.
Yeah.
Can we not do that now?
Now, you can find Kevin's blog online at sdpb.org/Wooster. Now, Kevin doesn't get to spend time with his grandchildren, but for many parents, maybe they're spending more time with their children than they'd currently prefer. Balancing work at home while making sure your kids are doing schoolwork is definitely difficult. Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University, and she joined Lori for a discussion about parents trying to find that balance between being a parent, a teacher, and working from home.
Emily, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here again.
And we appreciate you adjusting your time for us. Everything seems to be an adjustment right now, doesn't it?
Everything is an adjustment, exactly. You may hear my children in the background.
That will be perfect. And they are welcome on the radio, because this phrase, parenting in the open, is something that you wrote about online. And you joined us here in South Dakota on the phone when Crib Sheet came out. And that book has been so useful for us. We pass it around the studio and use it as a reference point for lots of journalistic work that we do as well. So thank you for that. And now you're talking about what is this like, as so many parents just almost immediately have had to make some pretty major adjustments to their life. Tell us a little bit, as a professor at Brown and as a parent and as an author, what's happened in your personal life that's changed, or what, maybe I should ask you what hasn't changed, but...
Yeah, no, it's what hasn't changed. I mean, I think, you know, I am having the same experience a lot of us have, which is I'm trying to sort of literally do these two things at the same time. And, you know, I think I want my kids to, as much as possible, experience this, like, not as a terrible and anxiety-provoking experience, but as a sort of fun thing that happened. You know, my kids are not that old, and so even though I'm pretty anxious, I'm trying not to project that. But that partly means I'm trying to, like, run a fun homeschool while also trying to, you know, prepare to online teach my classes. And so everything is just overlapped in a way that it hasn't been in the past. I have very little sort of focus time for work, and in some ways little focus time for parenting. So it's been an adjustment, you know, not all terrible, but it's definitely really different.
There's such a feeling of anxiety and fear too, because parents with small children are also afraid of not only their kids getting sick, but of themselves getting sick. And who's going to take care of my kids if I get this disease? So let's talk about that anxiety and how do you manage it and stay on top of it and yet somehow keep it developmentally appropriate for kids?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing is sort of like, we have spent a lot of time emphasizing to the kids that, like, they, you know, that there are things we can do to protect ourselves, but not trying to bring the kind of fear that I think as adults we're feeling, like, trying not to bring that in. My kids' school actually did a really good job before they stopped having it. Of telling them, you know, this is, like, here are some precautions you should take, wash your hands and so on. But, you know, coronavirus is mostly not very serious in children. So I think we're trying to dial down their kind of fear about themselves. Mm-hmm. And then just really not project us, while at the same time trying to be careful. And I will say I'm not always successful. You know, like, maybe 10 days ago, we went to a playground right before there was, like, no more playgrounds. Right. And once we got there, I realized this is a terrible idea. And I was sort of just like, okay, we can't be here anymore. And I think I really scared the kids, which was not my intention.
Yeah. And I just love admitting that stuff. You know, some of the things that we just do, and sometimes we just break down. We're parents. And that's something that you talk about in your book, is, like, some things have to work for, you know, what's the data tell us? What is it? What is our responsibility to do? And then what works in your family? And in this case, in some ways, it doesn't matter what works in your family, because everybody's being asked to do this this really hard thing for the greater good. you're out of options.
Yeah. And I think also being, I think that there's a, you know, a lot of what I write about in the book is about this sort of like performative parenting and the idea that you have to be doing it right and so on. And I think we've all now been thrust into a place where like, it was great to worry about, should we give our kid a half an hour of screen time? But now it's like, where's the TV? You know, like I am really not that focused on this question anymore. And I think that's it's probably that, that piece of it's probably a bit healthy.
Yeah. Wasn't that quaint when we wondered about that?
So yeah, exactly.
There are things that we think now that we're like, wasn't
that quaint?
Wasn't that quaint? That we thought that was important, and someday I hope that it will be top of mind again. Let's talk about working, because so many people are you know, maybe they've, people who have jobs, for starters, and who are privileged enough to still be working, because the unemployment records are I think 3.3 million nationwide right now, people filing for employment. So if you have a job, though, you're also sort of desperate to keep it right now, and you're trying to figure out how to work at home. And tell me a little bit about this piece that you wrote about parenting in the open and just parents, you know, being on a Zoom call with their kids around them in a way that you would not have seen a month ago.
Yeah, so I mean, I wrote about this months and months ago, not in the context of the virus, about the idea that we should be more open about the things that we're doing in parenting. And then it sort of came up again because this has been forced upon us, right? Yeah. Like now I'm on the, you know, I'm on the Zoom call and my son is running in totally naked and being like, I'm done pooping, come wipe me. And you're like, oh my gosh, okay. Yeah, it's just a moment, I'll be right there. And I think, you know, that has challenges. And I think we're, you know, trying to focus while you're doing this is hard, but I think there are maybe some good things, which is, you know, it's not so terrible for the people that I work with to understand the things that I'm, doing, you know, that I'm trying to also manage it at home. And I think simultaneously, you know, for the other side, you know, people me understanding, okay, what are my colleagues dealing with? I think that you know, that has some value, and maybe when this is all over, we will kind of be a little bit more thoughtful about the ways that we structure our work around these other obligations that we all have, whether it's kids or older parents or other, you know, people in the household.
You mentioned just this idea of you know, I'm thinking back to that video, and I'm going to forget who it was, but there was a male professor, I think he was from England, and he was on the news. This is long before, and his little toddler,
Korea and the kid.
Right? His little kid comes wheeling in, and his wife, or the mother of the child, just comes crawling in the room and like just trying to steal the. And it was such an example for, it was so funny, and lots of people shared it online, but it was also an example of how we expect our children to be invisible in the world, like that we immediately react like, no, don't be seen. You're a child and I'm a professional. When did we ever get the idea that that was the standard in the first place for men or women?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that, you know, when I listen to these conversations about like maternity leave that we've been having a lot, they're really like, which are great. And I think we should have more maternity leave for when you have a baby. But I think almost all those conversations sort of then end. It's like, okay. And then when the baby's 4 months, they'll just go back to work and they'll just be like it was before. And it's like, well, the baby's not going anywhere.
Right.
And somehow we have sort of gotten into this idea that like, you're going to have this kid, but you're not going to talk about it. And even, you know, actually my job sent some telecommuting instructions. And one of the things that they said was, you know, if you have other dependents in your house, explain to them that you'll need to be focused when you're on a work call. And my husband was thinking, was like, oh, I'll just explain to our 4-year-old, I'm sorry, this is a work call. I'm going to need to be focused. And so it's sort of, you know, it feels like that's not realistic.
Yeah. We had a work meeting the other day, and the best part of the meeting was when somebody's kid and it wasn't a bad meeting, but somebody's kid interrupted and you could hear them. And then my teenage daughter came in and played her accordion. And it was just one of those things where like, here we are, we're real people and we're still doing our jobs, but we're real people as well. I think that performative parenting, like you're not, but I want to ask this question because for so many people, one of the challenges about being a parent and leaving work when your kid is sick, for example, in regular times, is that there are other people who are not parents who are like, well, you know, I matter too. My time matter. How come, you know, how come mom over there gets to go home earlier? Whatever. It can cause a competitive nature or a special treatment kind of feeling that everybody is worried about. How can we approach that a little more humanely?
I mean, I think that that is hard because of course there are these inherent fairnesses. And I think part of it is recognizing that, you know, kids are one kind of constraint, but almost everybody has other things in their life other than their job, you know, and some of it is, you know, some of it is your parents or your spouse or your, or even like a hobby, you know. And I think part of making this sort of recognizing that people are whole people beyond just their role at work. I think that, part of what we can do there is try to make the workplace recognize all of the pieces of people, whether they're kids or something else. But I mean, I think the truth is that kids are very constraining, and that, you know, there is a time that kids are around at the end of the day. It's like, you know, 5 to 8. And I think we need to be open about that idea that, okay, I'm happy to work just as much as you, but there are some times when I am not really able to be there because those are the only times I can see my kid. And, you know, I am willing to put in time at other times. And I think that we could try to introduce that kind of flexibility, which would maintain some fairness.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about just the house, you know, life inside the house, because in some ways the kids do need to understand that things have changed. How can you set up a structure of some kind that makes sense for kids and for parents so that something can get done, even if it's not everything that we would like to get done?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, everyone has approached this a bit differently. I was on a call the other night and, you know, we had sort of a range of different levels of schedule. You know, my sense is of what has sort of worked for some people is kind of having some, you know, scheduled activities for the kids so they sort of know what is expected for them. And some of that basically depends on how old your kids are. I do sort of see this in part as an opportunity, and maybe this is reflecting how old my kids are, but partly as an opportunity to like encourage some independence in them and have them recognize, you know, yeah, like I'm parenting in the open at work, but I'm also working in the open in parenting. And my kids need to understand if I say this is an important work call, I may not be able to help them right then. They may need to, you know, pitch in a little bit more to get themselves ready in the morning, get themselves ready in the evening. And so I think that we can, you know, again, in silver lining land, you know, think about using that as a way to kind of encourage independence, which I think we're all looking for in our kids, but is actually kind of hard to enforce in normal times.
I talked to a friend last night who said, you know, I'm sorry about your education, but right now it's going to have to wait. And she, you know, she's sort of joking a little bit, but what she was saying is this idea that I'm supposed to keep my full-time job, which I, again, feel very grateful to have during this time of unemployment. She's working in a somewhat new position at work. She's like, I have to show up right now. Her kids are a little older. So they, you know, they're a little more independent. But the idea that she should now also be tasked with homeschooling, which is, you know, these kids had wonderful teachers that they loved. And she's like, your education's going to take a dip. And that's just the reality of this thing. I mean, how much can a parent shift to being a homeschooler, you know, quickly in a way that I guess we're all balancing these really, really divergent priorities right now? It just seems and feels kind of impossible.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I talked to somebody the other day who was explaining, like, you know, I know people who do homeschooling and these people are all in on it. Like, this is one of the two parents is engaged in taking up a curriculum and organizing a homeschool. And they think about it in advance and they get materials and somehow to say that, like, I will be able to achieve that kind of experience with the, you know, in with 1 week notice. And also while trying to do a different job, I mean, I think that's just not realistic. And of course, we can rely on our kids' schools a bit for this kind of distance learning, although I think that that's really hard. And so I think what your friend said is kind of the way I would put it too. Like, you're going to have to let it go a little bit. And the image that we all had, you know, 2 weeks ago, which is like, this is an opportunity for my kid to really, I'm going to teach them so much. We're going to have, you know, it's like, okay, here's the iPad. I hope that you do some educational apps some of the time. And, you know, I think that's okay. I mean, that is, you know, we're going to have to get through this, and everybody is going to make some choices, and that is okay.
I talked to a business ethicist who was walking business owners through this idea of, when do you let people go? When do you keep them? What's your responsibility to your customers, to your employers? And, you know, we have a low unemployment rate in South Dakota. It's hard to find people to, you know, to fill some of those positions. And his recommendation was, you know, think back to just a month ago, a few days ago, mm-hmm. even, when it was so hard to find qualified people. Maybe you should think about keeping some of those people right now through these hard times. What are your thoughts for employers who are looking at these employees? And again, it can be an opportunity, don't you think, for people to really see, like, this is what somebody's home life is actually like. They come to work and they are super dedicated. I value them even more. Can we all value each other even more a little bit now?
Yeah, I hope we can all value each other even more and recognize that, you know, we're all making some sacrifices for ourselves, but also for other people. And as you say, yeah, I think that for employers who can, the possibility of continuing to pay your workers or keeping people on, I think is really valuable. And, you know, to the extent that those of us who still have resources can try to spend them a little bit to sort of keep some of these local businesses afloat. You know, I know a lot of businesses, small businesses are trying, you know, in Rhode Island at least, are trying hard to sort of keep the lights on by being creative. The bookstore now delivers activity books to my house if I want. And so I think, you know, trying to keep supporting those while maintaining this kind of social distancing that we need, I think that's hard, but something we need to try.
As an economics professor and as an author of these books that really crunch into the data of this, part of you at least has to be, you know, popping with ideas for when this is all over. What is going to need to be unpacked? What do you think are some of the most interesting things that are happening now that are worth exploring later, that are really going to have meaning in the days to come?
I mean, so I think that one of the things we'll see a lot of people trying to study in the wake of this is the impacts on education and in particular sort of thinking about inequality. I think one very unfortunate aspect of this is that the same way that when kids, you know, leave school for the summer, we see more what we call summer melt in low-income populations. That's going to be true here, too, that the, you know, resources available to people who have highly educated and wealthy parents are going to be very different during this period than other groups. And so I think we'll see some people trying to sort of understand the inequality of the education system a bit through that. So I think my guess is, at least in the space that I am sort of most in, that is the thing that we will see the most papers on. Also fertility. So I think there's a question of, are people going to have a lot of babies?
That is
because they're sitting at home with nothing to do.
Or maybe they're not going to have any more ever again because they're sitting home with their first two children. Yeah. They're like, we're done.
I saw some people noted that there would be a baby boom, but only in first birth.
Right. Have you talked to families who are also, you know, women especially, who are also in that sandwich moment where they're taking care of their kids, you know, working, being asked to homeschool, and taking care of their parents, their elderly parents? Do you have friends that's sort of what they're suffering through right now?
Yeah, and I think actually a big thing a lot of people are struggling with, particularly because we're actually not very far from New York, and I have a lot of friends and people I know who have elderly parents in New York, and there's a question of, like, should I bring my parents to live with me and then, you know, not only be trying to homeschool and also to work at my full-time job, but also, like, monitor, you know, my parents, and yet it seems like, you know, leaving your elderly, you know, somewhat unhealthy parents in New York is also seems not good. So I've seen a lot of people struggle with that, and, you know, with the idea question of exposing your kids to your parents and, you know, what do you do in that situation? I think and even for us, my kids haven't seen their grandparents in a little while. They're used to seeing them a lot. I think it's been really hard for them and really hard for our parents as well.
Now, artists and arts organizations have really been hit hard during the economic disruption of the coronavirus pandemic. So we decided to welcome an artist who's really trying to find new ways to deal with this new normal.
We welcome Talon Bazil. Thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We are going to play some music here pretty shortly of yours, but let's get to know you a little bit. You're from Pierre, and to tell us how this coronavirus and COVID-19 outbreak has really been affecting your life.
Yeah, I live in Pierre. I'm originally from the Crow Creek and Cheyenne River tribes, Dakota and Lakota. I'm by and large a hip hop artist, but, I have to admit primarily, you know, I'm not as affected as an individual artist as others are, though I'm extremely sympathetic to it because I have so many friends who are artists who make their living off of, you know, performing gigs and going to different schools or, you know, some of the traveling that they do. And, but another part of my artistry is within running a studio. So on the Crow Creek Reservation, once a week, I have like a 3-hour open studio session that people can come to in the community and use for free. And the real unfortunate thing that I'm really trying to figure a way to mitigate is, I can't go over there and record these artists anymore. And for many of them, it's their only way to record. And for many of them, it serves as like a therapy for them because it's the only space that they have and access that they have to creating music. Some of them even, you know, to be around that sort of energy. So, I'm just trying to deal with it the best I can. And lately I've been live streaming on my Facebook more and more and more just to kind of try to send a positive energy out there and show myself making in hopes that maybe, you know, other artists who are feeling that probably anxiety and depression right now, maybe share some positive light or inspiration or for those learning to kind of teach them how I do it. And then also, you know, since I'm not really affected financially by this, from my live streams, I'm using it as a way to promote my friends who are artists, their donation links. Suffered major losses. So, you know, that's kind of how I'm handling it.
Let's give that to people now for a minute. Tell us about this. We've got the three songs. Hopefully we can get to all three of them, but tell us about this first song that we're going to hear.
So this first song is called Alternate Dimensions. It features Cody Blackbird of the Cody Blackbird Band and Jess James from DCM Collective. Both are, you know, NAMI award-winning artists, and I'm so lucky to got to work with them, in particular with Jess James under a residency last November. The song is an introduction to a 3-part album series that we recorded during the residency, which is called Traveling the Multiverse with Iktomi. And it's about, you know, this multiverse being, you know, we're all facing this world with our own universe. We all have our own beliefs. We all have our own perspectives on things. Even if we're from the same tribe or the same community or the same family, we're all different in our own way. And I wanted to appreciate that in the other artists. And the Iktomi part comes in as, you know, kind of letting not exploiting the negative, not, you know, trying to put a false hope on the negative, but letting it be what it is. So that way people who are going through that or who live certain lifestyles right now, so that way they have something, because I think everybody deserves some sort of thing. And as musicians, me as an artist, you know, and as a human, I'm in and out of different walks of life, and I'm friends with so many different people that I want to show them all love. And I don't want to take a blind eye to the real struggles going on where we're from on the reservation, you know, not even considering this pandemic, but the other epidemics and pandemics we're going through on the reservation, the whether it be drug use or suicide or even just depression and all that stuff going on. So putting a human light to it and a spiritual light for those who want it. So that's the song. It kind of introduces the whole vibe of our project that we've created.
Beautifully said. Let's take a listen to Alternate Dimensions.
Poker hay when I'm on the plane. Poker hay when I'm driving lanes. Lots of men need to drive ways, and I pray to them to find strength. Been through hell, but I'm heaven bound. Praying hard as the drum pounds. My spirit was in the lost and found. Jesus took it and tossed around. All my books talk about the ground. All my looks give me looks now. See my res, baby, walk around. You'll see why I don't floss now. Used to stroll all across town, writing scrolls as I jot down rhyme style. Then I came home with thoughts piled and saying so. Mama taught me to pray though. Papa said when you're way old, you'll understand that I'm teaching you what not to do. It's okay, yo. Lot of paths I've seen the roads, driven on by our watch the souls. I ain't approached with caution though. Stayed 80 on black guys. Since surviving, I take life in my hands to my grave site. Been through hell, but I sense light. Demons both have chimes, not hopping on the old I did. But you must know that I've been legit. Everything in my way now. All I'll say is pray for it. Take it down and I'm on it. Too many fake, now I'm cautious. They had me feeling so nauseous. But now I'm here and I'm polished.
On a one-way ride, on my only way home. This is who I am, this is really all I know. This is really all I know. Can't stop now, I won't even go slow.
Man, I came from nothing. Tripped out how I even function. Always had to deal with. Now I'm gonna rise above it. We losing our young ones. I wish heaven would teach you. Used to hate where I come from. Now I speak for my people. Didn't wanna be bothered. Ever felt like nobody gon' need you? That was like losing my father. Face down with a heroin needle.
That was Alternate Dimensions featuring Cody Blackboard and Just James, produced by DJ Spicy Ketchup. And my guest is Talon Basil. We're reaching him on the phone from Pier. Talon, I want to get to this. First of all, that's just amazing. And I think a lot of people needed that today.
Thank you.
So major compliments. Let's get to make, I want to make sure we hear the full next song. So Watch Over Me. Tell me a little bit about this. Set it up so we can hit play.
Yeah, so I mentioned before, I run Wonahun Washte Studio. It is a name gifted by Chie General Thunderhawk, who really helped us start spiritually with how we were going to approach this studio and what it was going to be intended for. And this was the song that came before we even had our studio set up. So it is featuring Royce Howe Jr., one of my younger cousins, and another younger brother of mine, Bobby J., both from the Crow Creek Sioux tribe, both around 19 or 20 in age. And it's about Javon Shields, a young man who passed away a couple years back, and someone they both considered a brother in their own ways. And this was how they dealt with it. And it's kind of what we're about at the studio. Not that everything has to be a message or a dedication, but, you know, people have these things that they need to get out, and it's, our studio speaks for itself. Over half of our songs deal with death and people who've passed. And our compilation album, which is available at basildx.bandcamp.com, features more artists just like this who, you know, have so much talent but just need that access. So this is them.
Hey!
watch over me, J Boog. Page at the page, rhyme at the rhyme. Always on my mind, any other day, any other night. What do I do? What do I say when I ain't feeling fine? Looking for the truth, looking for a sign. About to give up, so sick of trying. Then I look up into the sky, think about you, then I start crying. Man, I miss you, what's the use of trying? Every single time that I sit alone in my room, think about the late night cruising, sparking up. Now my little homie gone, man, rest in peace to you. Now, this is what I gotta do when I boo, when I come through with something new. Oh me, always in the rear view, clear view, in the visions up ahead. I'ma do this all for you, that's a bet. I ain't got none to lose, I'ma take every step, every breath. Got something to prove, 100 proof with the flow, thought you knew. In my own lane, still got my roots, stand in the rain while I rap to you. Take the pain away if I ever meet with you, rain or sunny days. Still I think about you. No time, ask God why, so I leave it up to you.
And now it's time for poetry from Studio 47.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Seamus Heaney. Heaney was born on April 13, 1939, on his family farm, Mossbawn, in Northern Ireland. He grew up in the countryside, which deeply affected his poetic sensibilities. His father was a farmer and cattle dealer, and he came from a large Catholic family. Heaney attended Queen's University Belfast, where he graduated in 1961 with first-class honors. While at Queen's, his love of poetry was ignited, and he devoted himself to writing. He was a lecturer at St. Joseph's Teacher Training College in Belfast before taking up a lectureship at Queen's. In 1965, he married Mary Devlin, and they started a family. As the Troubles began in Northern Ireland, as political violence and bombings became a part of daily life, the Heaneys, like many others, moved to the Republic of Ireland. He would spend the rest of his life living just south of Dublin in Sandymount. As he published more and more books, his fame increased. Soon he was teaching part-time at Harvard University. He held the Professor of Poetry chair at the University of Oxford, and he delivered readings around the world. His many, many books include Death of a Naturalist, Door into Dark, Wintering Out, North, Station Island, Seeing Things, The Spirit Level, District and Circle, and Human Chain, among many others, including plays, translations, essays, and published lectures. Heaney won just about every major literary award possible in Britain and Ireland, the M. Foster Award, the T.S. Eliot Prize, the Whitwood Prize, the Forward Prize, and the Nobel Prize in Literature. When he received the news that he had won the Nobel Prize in 1995, Heaney was asked what it meant to join the likes of other Irish writers, writers like W.B. Yeats, George Bernard Shaw, and Samuel Beckett. Heaney replied, "It's like being a little foothill at the bottom of a mountain range. You hope you just live up to it." He went on to write more books, offer more lectures, translate more texts, and he became an ambassador of the power of words. At the end of his life, he was one of the most recognized poets in the world. And then, in 2013, after a fall in Dublin, he was hospitalized. Moments before he died, on August 30th, he texted a simple phrase to his wife, "Nolle temere," that's Latin for "do not be afraid." His funeral was broadcast on Irish national television, tributes poured in from all over the world, and he was buried in the graveyard of St. Mary's Church in Ballochy, not far from where he was raised and close to the graves of his parents. His headstone reads, "Walk on air against your better judgment." Today's poem is Digging. This poem, as I remember it, was my very first introduction to Seamus Heaney. My mother, you see, is from Northern Ireland, and my relatives used to own a family farm called Beech Lawn in County Antrim. This farm was in our family from 1620 to 1955, when my grandfather sold it. Generations of my ancestors can be found in the churchyard in Achillea. Is it any surprise, then, that I came to love Heaney's early poems about Irish farm life? I had the very good fortune to meet Seamus Heaney in 1994 when I was a student at Queen's University, Belfast. I was getting my MA in Irish writing at the time. One evening, while I was at the campus pub, I saw Mr. Heaney at a table with his friends. In a moment of daring and stupefying audacity, I approached his table with 2 pints of Guinness. Conversation stopped, and everyone looked at me. "Hello, Mr. Heaney," I said. "I'm a big fan of your work, and I was wondering if we could share a Guinness. Once you're finished with this," I held up one of the pints, "I'll leave." He studied me for a long time and said, "Are you American? What brings you to Belfast?" He obviously heard my accent, and after a little small talk, he opened a hand to an empty chair and said that I was welcome to join them. I have absolutely no idea what we talked about. I was far too starstruck for that. But when I finished my pint, I thanked everyone at the table and scurried away. Our paths crossed again a few years later in Dublin, and to my astonishment, he remembered me. I've met many people who have similar stories about meeting Seamus Heaney. He was kind and modest and brilliant. He is missed. I don't think our poem for today requires much of an introduction. It's about tending crops and growing up and finding your vocation. This is Digging by Seamus Heaney. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mold and the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Chris Loffrey and Lori Walsh, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.